Tiny houses are great, but for a lot of us, they're too tiny. How about just small?
So small is, it can be anything from a boathouse to a treehouse to a little backyard 10 by 12 structure, maybe with a sleeping loft in it, something temporary, something you could, your mother-in-law could live in, your daughter or son could live in when they're in college, you know, if they need a place in the backyard, they can't afford their own place. Or it gives you a lot more possibilities keeping it just small rather than tiny. And it's small enough so that you could move it if you wanted to.
That's Jean Stiles. We talk with her and her partner David Stiles about their new book, Building Small. Then the Airstream is the icon of travel trailers with a passionately devoted following.
I think the lovely thing about an Airstream is that, you know, when you own a house, you have a particular way in which you need to design your house. You need to think about other people, about money, about sort of society and impacts on that. But I think people go a little wild when they get an Airstream. And so being able to step inside somebody's Airstream is just a fantastic experience. You get to know them on a whole nother level. So that was definitely one of the most exciting parts of this project is understanding the community and the variety.
That's Karen Flett. She delves into the history and how-to of Airstream trailers in her book, Living the Airstream Life. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Where I live, house buyers tear down 10-year-old McMansions to put up even larger mega McMansions. 7 bathrooms aren't enough. 10 or 12 are the new norm. Such is life in the Hamptons, although, thankfully, houses in my own neighborhood of Springs still retain for the most part the working and middle-class dimensions of old. But could this era of excess square footage be coming to an end? More and more people are turning to simplifying their lives, whether out of ethics or necessity, or both. We all need to live more lightly on the planet, and many of us can't afford to live large anymore. We've already talked on Writer's Voice about tiny houses, dwellings so small they can be transported on a flatbed trailer. But those houses are really tiny, many of them well under 100 square feet, making them difficult for all but the most pared down and agile to live in them. My guests, David and Jean Stiles, have made a career out of do-it-yourself guides to building small structures. They started with backyard tree houses and went on to garden sheds, workshops, and cabins. They've just come out with their 17th book, which aims for the sweet spot between too tiny and bigger than you need. The small house you can build yourself for not a whole lot of money. It's called Building Small, Tiny Houses and Backyard Building Designs. The designs range from traditional Tudor timber frame to whimsical but practical structures that can be added to or moved around like building blocks. And the book gives detailed step-by-step instructions that give even the klutziest amateur the knowledge to build her or his dream small house. I spoke to David and Jean Stiles in their dream house, their renovated barn in East Hampton, New York, surrounded by David Stiles' beautiful hand-hewn carpentry. Well, David and Jean Stiles, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having us back.
Yes, nice of you to do this for us.
Well, actually, I'm so thrilled to have you on the show because I enjoyed all your books, but this one's my favorite. Building Small, Sustainable Designs for Tiny Houses and Backyard Buildings. First of all, tell us, what is a tiny house?
Well, to be honest, we prefer using the word small house. We're not locked in to the tiny house per se, where you've got it on wheels and you can move it anywhere. We find that very limiting.
Limiting because you're stuck with an 8-foot-wide house that you might not like, and the proportions are 8 by sometimes 12, 16, 18, but you're confined to that proportion.
Yeah, so we give it a little more leeway, and we the way we feel about it is it's more of a mindset. So small is, it can be anything from a boathouse to a treehouse to a little backyard 10 by 12 structure, maybe with a sleeping loft in it, something temporary, something you could, your mother-in-law could live in, your daughter or son could live in when they're in college, you know, if they need a place in the backyard, they can't afford their own place. Or it gives you a lot more possibilities keeping it just small rather than tiny. And it's small enough so that you could move it if you wanted to. And David and I, our first experience with a small house was when we were going to build a bigger house. And we talk about this in the book, and David can talk about how we built it. But what happened was we bought some land. We drove around. We loved where it was, but we weren't really sure where to build on the property. So we thought, well, let's build a very small house, about 14 by 14, I think it is, or less.
12 by 12.
So we built it on the land so that we could camp in it. We could stay in it for the weekend, and we could watch the sun come up and the sunset and hear the birds and know which way we wanted to face with our bigger house that we were going to build someday. And of course, we fell in love with the small house. We never built a bigger house, and we camped in that little house whenever we were up there, and we thought, God, thank heavens we didn't build a big house. This is perfect. David can tell you how we built it.
Well, before that, I'd like to mention, everybody thinks about or asks about land. Where do I find some land if I'm going to? And what we did is we went to live in New York City, and we drew a circle on a map, 50-mile radius, and drove up north and looked at small towns. And as it was, a little car, we had a mini moat car that we had then, it started to overheat. So we stopped at a little brook, and there was a woman raking leaves. And we asked her, is there any property around here? And she said, well, matter of fact, the woman I bought property from is still selling, I think. And we contacted her, and we got 25 acres for a very cheap price. And we built on it, and that was it. That's how we got it. But the point is, if you go around asking people, rather than going to the real estate people or the nearest classified sector, farm acreage and that sort of thing, just ask a lot of people in the neighborhood that you think you'd like to live in. That can work wonders for you.
And so all these years later, do you still have that property?
We sold it, but we did use it for a very long time. It was really our getaway. And we had it designed so that you could heat it up within an hour. You could get it. We had a little wood-burning stove that you fed wood from the outside, from a little tiny deck. We had it on stilts. It was on a pond, a small lake. And we could get it heated up in about a half an hour. David designed everything on the inside so that, like a train, where the bed folded down, the table folded down, everything was very perfectly designed, so you could pack a lot in there, and you could be very cozy and comfortable. Mm-hmm. So it was good.
So great. Now, that's not in this book, Building Small.
We have.
Oh, it is.
Uh-huh. We do have it in the.
Well, let's turn to it.
Page 74. Right here.
Weekend retreat on the Hudson River. So, describe what we're looking at here.
Well, you're looking at a house on four posts. On the water, it's got a flat roof that overhangs, a deck on one side with a little stove that you can feed very quickly. You can get a fire started very quickly with small pieces of wood. And there's a door. Actually, the deck goes around on two sides, I'm remembering now. And the door opens up, and you can. We had a ladder that went up to the side, and you can get in. Just, I don't know, the fact that it got warm so quickly was a big plus. We had 14-foot posts, buried them in the ground with cement around them, and we've got the materials list. We've got everything in here, yeah.
Yeah, that's a thing that I love about this book, is actually you have pretty complete plans, yeah, about how to build these things. Now, how long did it take you to build this little house on the Hudson, and how much did it cost? How much do you think it would cost in today's dollars, if you could figure that out?
Well, I think back then it cost about $2,000, but I used redwood and cypress, or very expensive materials, to do it. But today you might double that. But it was we built all of it by hand. There was no electric going there, so it was very time consuming. We had to even rip long boards, you know, the lengthwise, and by with a handsaw, and that sort of thing. But I enjoyed it, and we had a good time camping out there. We would camp out in the winter, and we'd go skiing or ice skating, and we'd come in and make some hot chocolate and sometimes sleep over. It was just perfect.
We had a little boat on the water, so in the summer we could go out and paddle around in the boat. I mean, it was kind of an ideal, very inexpensive, small weekend house. But someone could live in there all the time if they wanted to, really. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, we're working in the city, so it wasn't practical to be there all the time. But you could.
Well, talk about the kind of mindset that it would take to live in a house that small.
Jeannie, maybe you're better at this.
Well, I did include a section in the book called Living Small Success Stories. And that was very interesting to me because each person that I interviewed and actually had them write a small piece on their success, living small, they all had very different stories, everything from a more sophisticated house, you know, I guess the biggest of the small houses, to Crooked River Tiny House, which Lon Cameron uses now as strictly as a Airbnb, but he started out living in it himself. Then the smallest, which really represents a total mindset, is Dakota and Andrew, who decided they were going to spend almost a year they put together a whole system in their van so they could travel all over the United States and live on very little. And although this is not a story about building, it is about the mindset that goes with people who do build small. And they just had wonderful adventures. You know, they camped out and they had this set of drawers in the back of, we show it in the book, a set of drawers that contained all of the necessities that they felt they were going to need. And they did it, and they were very happy about it. And they've got some great stories, and they tell a good story in the book.
Well, even my house is in your book.
That's right.
In fact, I met you because I was going to the general store one day, and I saw a little sign saying that there was a Tudor shed for sale, and I saw the picture and I totally fell in love, and I bought it from you guys. It was your demonstration model, put it up, and now it's my writing studio. So talk a little bit about that. Was that your first small house of that kind, that small?
No, I think we built a lot of others before that. And
this was timber frame.
This one in particular was timber frame. And what is timber frame? Well, it's instead of conventional 2x4 framing, it's using heavy timbers. And the advantage to that is it makes it a lot stronger. There's examples of timber frame houses going through tremendous fires, and the timbers, since they're bigger and heavier, keep the house standing. And whereas, the limp-wristed 2x4s are going to burn right out. So we made it out of timber framing. For your listeners, that timber framing is when you mortise and tenon, that is, you cut a hole in, a post, and you cut a tenon, which is a peg, and you slip that peg into the post, and you lock it with a peg. And it takes more time, but for anybody who's ever done this, you'll ask anyone, they find it very satisfying. They're very proud of the work that they've done.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Gene and David Stiles about small houses you can build yourself. Their new book is Building Small. So we are still in hurricane season here. We have so far dodged the bullet, but other places have not. Would a timber frame house be able to stand up in a hurricane?
Much better than a conventionally framed house. But you would have to lock it down, anchor it down to the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's true of any house.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's something I ought to do. It could become my hurricane refuge. So what are some things to keep in mind when building a tiny house,
well,
or just a small house?
Okay, a small house, for instance, if you're going to build it near your house or in your backyard, or is it? Are you going to have to drive 20 miles or something to get to it, or in our case, 120 miles? You have to think about that and think about where your supplies are, where how far away it is from electric box or even plumbing or. And all those things, you have to think about permits. You have to think about get the town to approve of your building if it's over 200 square feet. And that's, by the way, in most cases in the United States, 200 square feet or less, you don't need a permit. But don't swear on that, because you have to check your own town.
So you could do a 200 square feet. You could do, 12 by 12 or 14 by 14.
Yeah, yes, exactly. 12 by 12, 14 by 14 is just 6 feet over. But that's, we have one building in our book that is 14 by 14. And that's a backyard building intended to be used by your grandfather or maybe your student or anybody or a guest. We call it a Japanese guest house because it looks a little bit Japanese. Mm-hmm. But that's a 14 by 14, and it costs, believe it or not, $20,000 in materials.
Why so much?
The reason why so much? Well, it's a lot. It's everything. It's interior, and the reason it's not more is because it's on posts, and you don't have to get a concrete truck going into your backyard, ruining your irrigation system, and going through fences and everything. You can actually build the first deck that the house is on by yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't need extra help, and that makes it a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful house. It's a hip roof.
A pyramid roof, four-sided pyramid roof with a skylight on top. And the skylight on top allows light to come, bathe the whole interior, and has a fold-down bed, and it has a tiny kitchen, it has a bathroom, and it has a place for your TV set and a desk that convert into a dining room table. So, and it has a shower outside, and the idea there is, this is interesting, the shower is not in a room, it's outside, and we think it would be really cool to turn on the shower from the inside, wait till it gets warm, take off your clothes and run outside into this shower, which is only a few feet away. Take your shower and you'd look over the top of it and see all the beautiful things in nature, and then run back in, turn off the shower and warm yourself.
That sounds great.
And I know a little while ago we were talking about timber framing as being a more of a classic, a sturdy way of building something. And we have something in the book called Timber Frame Micro Barn that is a great example of that someone built out here on Long Island. And we put it up for them, and they did the interior. They put a really cool loft bed in it with some handmade circular stairs. It ended up being a real successful backyard venture for him, and he uses it to write in, and of course his kids can sleep in it at night if they want to get out of the house. It's got a lot of light in it, special round windows. He used to be in the Coast Guard, so he's got some great things left over from ships and French doors that open up, so he can get a lot of light in there, a lot of ventilation there, and he's going to add on to it. That's another thing you can do with some of these. If the mindset of living small, I mean, sometimes you do have to add on a little bit if you have kids, if you're working there and living there. And we like the idea of designing something where you have the ability to add on to it if you need to. But he wants to put more of a kitchen and an eating area because he's a very good chef. Mm-hmm. So, and you could do it easily with this design. It's be perfect. He calls it a micro barn. I love that name.
Now, you also have the sugar cube house. Is that an example of something that can be added onto?
Yeah, this is one of my favorites. What it is a simple idea that if you're a student and you graduated and you have a huge student loan, you need some place to stay. And what you could do is ask your parents if you could build an 8x8x8 cube in their backyard. And if they say yes, then you could set this thing up. You could actually sleep in it. You'd have a small bath. and you would use their bathroom, but you'd use their electric, but you'd have a place. It's almost like another room to their house. And what it means is it gives you independence from your parents. And in a way, that's going to be what the parents want too sometimes. And the idea is that it can all be taken down. Say the student gets a job in a nearby town or something. This all comes apart, unscrews, and can be put on a trailer flat and taken to another site and put up again. Then if you say, get married, you need a bigger place, you can add another cube on, and that cube would become the bedroom. And then if you want, you can have another cube that attaches to it, and that would be the bathroom. So you would have basically kitchen, bedroom, and bathroom. And there's an eating place outside if the climate is okay.
Now, you can build it so that you can put doors in?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The doors can be put in to connect all three.
And that's at any time you can do that. How do you do that?
Well, when you're building your first one, you probably frame out for the door, but you don't put the door in. Or you could put the door in. Mm-hmm. It would be like a side door.
This could be for anybody. I mean, not just a student. You know, that's just one scenario. It could be for anybody who's just looking to build a small house that they might want to add on to and they might want to move.
And each cube is about $2,000 in material, so
That's right, about $2,000 in materials. And it can be put up by two people or perhaps three, because you have to push the roof up. You have to build a roof on the ground and lift it up and push it up there. So you need about three people to do that. But the rest of it could be first done by a single person, building the walls and everything, and then putting it up. You need a couple of people at least in addition.
Now, you tell us some of the stories in the book. You've mentioned a few, but what's your favorite?
Well, let's see.
Or one of your favorites.
Well, one of my favorites is I love this Crooked River, Tiny House Crooked River, and they have done a great job with their small space storage solutions. I tried to show pictures of a lot of these, but everything from the stairway to the chairs that they sit on have a little shelf and then a bottom that flips out. You know, they're made out of boxes, but they look great. You know, they just, the imagination and the thought they put into it to make it work, you know, for someone. And they actually have two or three little houses on their property. One is just a, you know, a bathroom underneath and above with a screened-in porch, so you could if it's really warm out, you can go up there. And one is for storage. But the main one that people use they rent it from them as an Airbnb is the shingled one. It's got an outdoor shower. So, you know, you can kind of enjoy the indoors and the outdoors. The other one I'm thinking of that I haven't mentioned is the sauna hut in Nova Scotia, which a friend of ours, who's actually French, built this beautiful view of the water. And, you know, they go there for a couple of months every summer. They spend the whole, you know, 2 months with their kids, their grandkids, each other, and they live in the house, and then they built another small house they just use as a sauna. So there's a picture of the aerial view of it, which is nice. But he was happy to write about, you know, his experience in there. They love getting rid of, you know, they have so much stuff in Montreal because he's a designer and she's very creative. She does, you know, teaches people how to knit and weave and do all kinds of stuff. So you can imagine all of the things that you accumulate when you are an artist and you're a designer. And I think to be able to leave that for a couple of months and go somewhere where you're forced to pare down and really live with a smaller footprint, you know, more in a more ecologically, you know, eco-friendly way, it just makes you feel good. It makes you get through the rest of the year, I think. Mm-hmm. Even if you're not living there 12 months out of the year, it's a wonderful way of clearing your mind for a month or two.
Yeah, exactly. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jean and David Stiles about their new book, Building Small, Tiny Houses and Backyard Building Designs. So you opened up the book, David, to another one, The Versatile Tiny House?
Yeah, Versatile Tiny House. And we chose this because it's 12 by 10. And I just, doing all this research over years, and it's been, I don't want to mention how many years, we found 10 by 12 is a nice size. This particular tiny house, we call it tiny, but we call it small house, has a loft bed in it. It's made with 2x4s, conventional framing. And we have, in the book, 27 pages of how to do it. And the good thing about that is you can use this information for any small house you're doing. It has practically everything you can imagine, from foundations to how to do the electric and plumbing and whatever. You know, it's all in there in 26 pages. I think the book is worth it for that, by that alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's not the only house that you give pretty complete instructions on how to build.
Right. The rest of them have complete plans for seven. When I say complete, if there's something missing, it'll be in this chapter. For instance, how to put on an asbestos roof or how to put on a shingle roof. I mean, all that, you don't want to repeat that throughout the whole book, so you refer to this one to get that information.
Now, and there's also a very curious A-frame that seems to be kind of indoor-outdoor.
Is that Deeks?
Yes, Deeks. Yes.
Oh, that's a good design.
That's a very interesting design. It's our friend Dietrichson. I always pronounce his name Dietrichson. Dietrichson. He's quite a guy. He's done a lot of designs, small houses, shacks and shanties is one of them. He's written several books. And he combined with us on this, or we combined with them on this A-frame house. And it's... let's see, I did the plans for this. I don't know how big it is, but it's not big. It's enough for a camping, a cabin. And it's like a transformer. The side of the treehouse opens up, and you can slide out a couch, and your kitchen is in the back, and it's just perfect.
Yeah, he's very clever, and he's also done a lot of tree houses. We met him that way, actually. But I think this deck that comes out, he can double the size by the design so that you could actually sleep a couple of people in. There's a sleeping loft and this area that comes out with a roof that goes up. So he's made it so that you could actually probably sleep three people in there, I would say.
So the roof actually... it's an A-frame, so the bottom half of one side flips up to allow for now an outdoor space with the couch where somebody can sleep. Yeah, it's very interesting.
And this one, too, I don't want to forget this. This is in Santa Fe, so we tried to include different parts of the country. And this is an example of what people today would say a granny flat, but it is a perfect little house that my brother and his wife designed and built for my mom next door to their house. And I actually liked it more than their house. I mean, it's just a perfect house with lots of light, lots of skylights and windows, and it has an incredible porch, big sleeping porch with a table to eat at and a couch that opened into a double bed. And a couple of a little seating area on it, and that looked out, of course, at the mountains and the sunset every night, and a little garden in the back. So you felt like you were in a mansion. I mean, it was just perfect. Then there was two bedrooms, one little tiny one, which was also a studio, a living room, and her bedroom. The other thing in this area, you had your choice of building. If you had an accessory house, you had a choice of building a bathroom or a kitchen. Well, my mother did not like to cook, so she said, oh, bathroom, you know, we'll figure out how to eat. So then, you know, my brother put in a very minimal little area with a sink, a little stove, a little fridge, and it was plenty for her, you know, so it worked out perfectly.
I think the main thing to remember, though, is that what it did for the family. Here was Michael and Jane, Michael's her daughter, and she left, she lived next door to them for how many years? I guess maybe 15 years. And she lived down the road, and Michael would go visit her every morning rather than spend a whole lot on a nursing home, which would have cost a lot more. Mm-hmm. And she didn't want a nursing home anyhow. But, I mean, it was wonderful for the whole family. But we felt good because Jean, that's the mother, she died about 90-something, Jeannie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, she was in great shape the whole time. She didn't need even a retirement home. But just living alone is challenging when you're in your 90s. And I think it was nice to know that there was someone next door and she could have dinner with them two or three times a week. She'd have them over for a small dinner with a small kitchen. And so it was a nice way of sharing and having someone near you but keep your independence.
And it was even great for us. We could come visit her and keep her company and see her, and that was wonderful.
Well, there are just a slew of wonderful ideas in this book, Building Small, Sustainable Designs for Tiny Houses and Backyard Buildings. Thanks so much, Jeannie and David, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your enthusiasm for this is wonderful, and so is the book.
Oh, thank you very much, Francesca. We always love talking with you, and we're happy that you have one of our tiny houses, too, and you use it well.
I'm thrilled with it.
I'll say ditto to that, everything Jeannie said.
All right. Well, thank you both. David and Jean Stiles. You can find images of the small houses featured in Building Small by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Living the Airstream Life. Stay tuned after the break. And welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. With its distinctive silver bullet-shaped profile, the Airstream has been an integral part of the American recreational landscape for more than 85 years. Since the 1930s, thousands of Americans have traveled the highways and byways of our land in these trailers, which they often modify to their own individual and unique tastes. Today, these beautifully designed, nostalgia-laden vehicles are more popular than ever. Accompanied by loads of photos, Living the Airstream Life by Karen Flett tells the unique story of the designers who created the Airstream and gives tips for Airstream wannabes on how to become part of the community. Author Karen Flett has been a photographer, an interior designer, and an art department coordinator for major motion pictures. She says her love of Airstreams has come from her passion for sophisticated architectural design, sustainable living, and the freedom of travel and the open road. Well, Karen Flett, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So this book, Living the Airstream Life, first I just want to ask you, how did you get involved with this project?
I have a history. I've got a bachelor in design and a bachelor in architecture, and so I have a strong fascination with design in general. I've also been an interior designer and worked in feature films for a long time as well. So I love design, anything that has really good design in it. And I am also a big fan of traveling, an avid traveler, and I really like being able to be as mobile as possible. So it really combined in the fact that Airstream is just a combination of all of those things. So that's how I sort of fell in love with Airstreams. I came to be a writer through, I worked in feature films, and part of that we wrote behind the scenes books. So I worked on films like The Hobbit, and so I ended up being the managing editor for writing the Hobbit Chronicles books, which was a series of books behind the scenes and a few others as well. And I really loved being an editor, but followed my own passion, combined the Airstream, the design, the travel, and the writing together. And so that's how this project came about.
Well, I've long had, I'd call Airstream envy. Every time I see an Airstream going down the road, I think, oh, that's so beautiful. But I could never imagine actually buying one. In fact, I didn't even know that you could still buy them, that is, unless they were used. until picking up this book. So first of all, tell us just a little bit about the history of the Airstream. When did it start and who started it?
So it all started with a man called Wally Byam. And through the early, he grew up in the early 1900s and loved travel. He spent a lot of time with his family traveling and spending time sort of away from the big cities. And so during the late 1920s, he started building trailers. So he actually built the first one because his wife at the time didn't like the idea of camping and going setting up a tent. So he thought this was a nice compromise. And so that was his first inspiration. He started selling the design of his trailer because so many people were sort of asking him about it. So he started by selling plans and then actually selling kit sets and full trailers. By the early 1930s, he officially opened Airstream as a company. And throughout the 1930s, he developed a series of trailers. And then by the sort of mid to late 30s, he designed the first what we call sort of aluminum and rivets trailer, which is sort of similar to what the Airstream is today. And so he grew the business. Unfortunately, through the war, the business was closed down because of the requirement for aluminium for aircraft. And so through that period, Airstream closed down. But he also actually worked for an Airstream manufacturer, which actually helped him when he reopened Airstream after the war to understand some really great techniques in building aluminium shells and trailers and wind resistance and all of those things. So it was actually quite a benefit. And so after the war, they really did take off, got very popular, but a lot of people were sort of loved the idea but weren't taking them far from home. And his travelling spirit and his wanted, you know, to inspire people to not just take their trailers and set them at home, but actually the travel part of it as well, which was what his drive was in the first place. So he actually organised what they call caravans, which is a whole lot of trailers travelling together to support each other through different environments. And so he started off with some sort of national up to Canada and caravans like that, but he then took it to the next level. One of the most famous ones was he travelled through South Africa from Cape Town all the way up and actually through Europe as well. So he took these trailers everywhere. And so I think the history of it is that he himself and his wandering spirit and his passion for sharing the travel and the experience of meeting new cultures and being part of that has really embodied itself into the Airstream spirit. And I think that's, as you say, you know, I think a lot of people don't actually know that they're still created today, because the instant thing that you think about is that vintage and, you know, that wandering spirit that Wally really kind of put together there. But they are definitely still making them today, and they can't keep up with demand as well. They're very high demand.
Yeah, and I was surprised to find out, I mean, they're so well made that 70% of Airstreams that have ever been built are still on the road. Now, we're talking, it started in the 1930s, so some of them were coming, you know, not too far away from being centenarians.
Oh, yes, definitely. And a lot of them, like, they've obviously, they receive a lot of love. So they've, a lot of people who are collectors love them and refurbish them, but there's also very much original trailers from that time. Even there's original trailers from the time where he sold kit sets way back, even sort of before he sort of started the business, that still exists today. So they are, it's a testament to the durability of the Airstream itself, but also to the design and the spirit that Wally Byam put into it, because I think they were so loved that they, you know, were always kind of given pride of place.
So you're saying he sold kits, is that right? And people could build them themselves?
Yes. This was sort of very, very early on, before he sort of started Airstream. So they were a variation of his first mass-produced trailer, which is the torpedo trailer. So it's almost like similar to sort of a teardrop trailer that you would think of today, apart from it's sort of round the other way, as in the curved front is vertical rather than horizontal. But yes, please look at my book. There's examples of them in there, so if anyone's interested, just check them out there. But yes, they still exist today.
Yeah, and you do have wonderful illustrations in this book, Living the Airstream Life, and we are talking with the author, Karen Flett. Now, design. Tell us about the design innovations and also about the efficiency. I mean, is the design, which has stayed pretty much the same on the outside all these years, is it something that is sustainable given the need for efficiency?
Definitely. I think the design has changed slightly over the years, but as you say, the core of the design, which is aluminum panels and riveted together, is the same idea. But as technology has changed, the ability to manipulate that aluminum has changed as well. And so that's made it a lot more efficient in regards to shaping and sizing and how many panels. Earlier on, because the material was not very flexible at all, those curved panels at the end caps, they had a lot of segments. So some up to 13 segments just to make that end cap. Whereas today, the material is a lot more flexible, and so they only require 5. So they did go through a process of, as new technology sort of changed, those segments also were enabled to change, which meant the time spent sort of riveting them all together, and also the quality of the connections has definitely changed over time. So the exterior is a tried and true product. The aerodynamic qualities to that shape is incredible, which makes it very easy for beginners or novices to pull an airstring, because they're not being dragged around by their trailer, and the wind is actually going over it, which makes it really easy to sort of pull long distances, and also easier on your vehicle, your mileage as well, and things like that. So not only is it beautiful, but the efficiencies and the engineering behind it is pretty incredible as well.
So the name Airstream is a true moniker for this vehicle. It actually, the air streams around it.
Yes, it definitely does. It is what it says it is. And it's fantastic because a lot of the trailers, you know, or even motorhomes that are built today are so square mm-hmm. that it doesn't allow for that efficiency at all.
Now, you said that it makes it a lot easier to pull, of course, depending on the size, but are there airstreams that can be pulled by efficient vehicles, or does one have to pull an airstream with a gas guzzler?
It does depend on the size, and it also depends on the year that it was built as well. So the earlier airstreams are a lot lighter than the later airstreams. Basically, as sort of demand for higher end requirements of the modern day go into the airstream of today, they do get a bit heavier. The earlier ones in sort of the 50s and 60s were very light. They even were so light that they did do a marketing example of actually a bicyclist pulling one as well when they were in the early days as well. But today you do need something that does have a bit of power, but that doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be a gas guzzler. And the airstreams, you can get them as small as 16 feet today as well, so they can be quite small and quite efficient and get something that's actually really efficient to tow them.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, so talk a little bit about the interior of the Airstream. What is the design sensibility? How has that been applied to the interior?
So the interior has changed quite a bit over the years, primarily through different materials being used. So sort of in the 50s and 60s, a lot of real timbers and woods were used. Into the 70s, the cabinets were made from sort of an aluminum channel with veneer boards, which made them really light, but not probably as sort of durable as sort of the real woods 50s and 60s. In the 80s, they had a real amazing quality shift, and the 80s airstreams are just gorgeous, and in regards to even today, they stand the test of time. But I think what's exciting and what I found really interesting as well is what actually people do to change it for their own personality. So that's what I found so fascinating about the community. I think there are so many different people who enjoy airstreams and love airstreams, from sort of circus performers to families of 12 to pilots, architects, sort of every walk of life really does love an airstream. And so it was really fascinating how people made them their own. And that's probably one of the most exciting things I found about actually making this book, was talking to these people about why and how and what and how did they get to where they are. I think the lovely thing about an airstream as well is that, you know, when you own a house, you have a particular way in which you need to design your house. You need to think about other people, about money, about sort of society and impacts on that. But I think people go a little wild when they get an airstream, because it's like their own space that they have no one to answer to. And so they really just decorate them in such fascinating ways, because, you know, even if it's sort of an expensive material, they only need a little bit of it. And so they really do go crazy with what's in their heart and their soul and what they really, really love. And so being able to step inside somebody's airstream is just a fantastic experience. You get to know them on a whole nother level. So that was definitely one of the most exciting parts of this project, is understanding the community and the variety.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Karen Flett about living the airstream life. Could you give us an example of just, you know, one of those really amazing makeovers that just spring to mind?
Sure. Well, there is one couple who, Katie and Rob, who have 7 children of their own, and they also foster children, and they also have grandparents or their parents that travel with them as well. And so they were able to transform an 80s 32 XL, so 32-foot airstream, into being able to sleep 12 people really comfortably. They had a dishwasher, they had a long table that was able to seat 12, and it was incredible how they utilised the space, and also even made it so that, I love the story that like they have in rainy days and you've got 12 people in an airstream, it gets a bit crowded. And so they created these incredible games that they could play, utilising the space of the airstream, from sort of temp and bowling and things like that, so they could utilise that space as well. So every little nook and cranny of their airstream they had designed specifically for 12 people to live in. And they're in the book as well, so you could check out a few of the pictures under Katie and Rob in the DIY section.
Now, let's say somebody wanted to get an airstream. Talk a little bit about buying new versus getting a used one.
Sure. Well, I think it depends, and first and foremost is your own personal style. The newer airstreams are a lot bigger, and so that and wider. So that might mean that the style of them is a little bit different, and so a lot of people are like real vintage, really interested in vintage and the style and the way they look, and then other people really like the new and, you know, the new style. I think from an exterior point of view, one of the big differences, the earlier ones, I'm sure you've seen a lot of polished airstreams that look like mirror shine. So the vintage airstreams polish up like that, but not so much the brand new ones. Just because they put a really incredible water sealing coat on them, that does make it a little bit more difficult to polish up in that way. So if that's a look that you're going for, then that's probably something to decide about. As far as actually new versus vintage, I think the thing with new is that you you know everything's going to work. You know all the systems are going to work. You know that you've got a reliability there, whereas with vintage, it depends on the condition that the trailer is in. So there's a lot of professional designers who take vintage Airstreams and they almost bring them up to, well, they do bring them up to being the quality of a new one. So they put new systems in and new everything, but can keep it within sort of the vintage look or your own complete design. So as far as cost is concerned, they're probably comparable, taking a vintage and getting a professional designer to redesign it for you or buying a new one. If you're looking at buying a vintage one to take care of yourself or that you're going to renovate or that needs a bit of love, be really thoughtful about how much time, energy, money you have to put in them, because I think there are a lot of Airstreams that people sort of think, oh yeah, sounds like a great idea, I'm going to renovate, and they sort of have a tendency to pull everything out of the Airstream, and there's a lot of gutted Airstreams available for sale. And so it's just such a shame when people get halfway through a project and rip a beautiful Airstream to pieces. So I think it's just being aware of what you're capable of, what your budget is, and how much you intend to spend versus how much time and how much skill you have as well. Have you been someone who's dealt with plumbing, wiring, handyman work, or is this a brand new experience? So I talk a little bit in the book about budget and how much to expect to pay for all those different sort of areas. It's sort of the very high-end professional designer, you can spend over $100,000, but you can also get a trailer in pretty good sort of original condition for sort of $25,000 to $40,000, depending on what it is. I think the biggest key when buying vintage is actually to spend a bit more to make sure that it's been well looked after, because you could end up spending a huge amount more if it's been sitting in a paddock for the last 20 years and has had a lot of damage to it. So
and new ones, I mean, it surprised me, you can actually walk away with a new one for not that much more. It looked like they start about 33, is that right?
They do, yeah. I said 36, I think. I'd have to double check. They change a little all the time, but yeah, sort of the late 30s. They do. I think are a 16-foot sport. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and that doesn't seem to be all that much to spend. But of course, then you have to have the car as well.
You do, and I think a lot of people have a tendency to buy one that's maybe sort of 3-4 years old in regards to understand, you know, like they buy something that's sort of that price and that is a little bit older, so they can get an idea where the sort of size fits them and all those kind of things, so they can trade up or trade down without sort of having to sort of refinance too much. But there is a huge range for the new ones in regards to price.
Now, finally, can you put the Airstream within the context of, the recent increase in interest in tiny homes? What does it say about American values and changes in American values that the Airstream has had no drop-off in its popularity?
I think it has definitely very much boosted through the tiny home sort of movement. Also, the other thing was the 2008 financial crisis. I think that really made people think about where their money is and what are they doing with it and how can they be secure. And I think the tiny home movement has sort of come to the forefront through that process of people sort of prioritising what's important in their life. As far as that Airstream specifically is concerned, definitely as part of that tiny home movement is an option for that. And I think the tiny homes themselves, the wooden on built on a big trailer, they're not as aerodynamic or as easy to move. And so I think Airstreams particularly appeal to people who not only like to live in a smaller space to make the most of their life and their finances and their experiences, but also like to travel a lot more. And so with Airstreams, you get a lot of people who are a little bit more nomadic rather than just wanting to downsize to be able to be more efficient about their finances. That's probably the little bit of a difference. They love to actually travel and see new places.
Well, Karen Flett, the book is Living the Airstream Life, and it's just been great to talk with you about this iconic example of American travel style, the Airstream.
Thank you so much, and thank you for spending the time talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Karen Flett is the author of Living the Airstream Life. Next week, we talk with John Duberstein about his late wife Nina Riggs' beautifully written memoir of living and dying. It's called The Bright Hour. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.